This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. It's Friday, which means we're starting today's show with our Week in Review panel. And this week's news includes a tragic loss.
People can die in lots of different ways, but this way was the most horrific. And it haunts me.
That's John Foley speaking outside his house in Rochester, New Hampshire, about the death of his son, James, at the hands of Islamic militants. Also this week, the Ferguson protests fueled a conversation about police militarization. The ACLU of Massachusetts worries about SWAT teams and mission creep.
It is very easy when you have that capability to all of a sudden start using it in situations where they're not necessary.
Meanwhile, the primary in the race to be the next Massachusetts governor is fast approaching, and the candidates are making their final pitch to voters. Here's Republican Charlie Baker in his latest ad.
When I'm governor, we'll lower taxes, reduce wasteful spending, and reform welfare.
And the candidates for state attorney general square off over guns and marijuana.
We can't have drugs that are addictive be made that much more accessible and available. And this seems like the Wild West.
Joining me now to talk more about these stories and the rest of the week in the news is John Carroll, a Boston University communications professor and author of the Campaign Outsider blog. Hi, John.
Hi.
And also with us is Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker. Adrian, nice to have you back, too.
Hey, Sasha.
And John and Adrian, let's start off today with the death of James Foley. Again, New Hampshire journalist. He was a freelancer for the Boston-based news organization Global Post. Jim Foley was killed this week by the military group ISIS. He'd been captured 2 years ago while covering the conflict in Syria and held ever since. Just this morning, Jim Foley's parents made an emotional appearance on the Today Show. And here's Jim's father talking about a ransom email that the family received from ISIS just before their son was executed.
We hadn't heard from Jim's captors since December, and I actually was excited to see an email despite the conclusion that they would execute Jim. I underestimated that point. I did not realize how brutal they were, and I actually hoped we could engage in negotiations with them.
And here was President Obama on Wednesday speaking about James Foley, but notably not speaking about future U.S. actions against ISIS.
Friends and allies around the world, we share a common security and a common set of values that are rooted in the opposite of what we saw yesterday. And we will continue to confront this hateful terrorism and replace it with a sense of hope and civility. That's what Jim Foley stood for.
Adrian Walker, obviously an extremely tragic end to Jim Foley's life, a devastating outcome for Global Post and Phil Balboni, its CEO, who had worked so hard to try to win Foley's release. What did you think, Adrian, when you heard this?
You know, the cruelty of it is just astonishing and overwhelming to me. I had written about Foley the first time he was a hostage in 2011, and, you know, he was such a brave, courageous, dedicated journalist. And it's just shocking that it could come to this end.
You know, I noticed that the latest tally of the amount of people killed in the Syrian conflict as of today is closing in on 200,000 people. That's according to the UN. And I was thinking that, you know, even though Foley is one death, he was there to expose, you know, those tens of thousands to almost 200,000 deaths. You know, someone to be chronicling that civil war, making sure that civilian deaths and war crimes and other atrocities are brought home, that someone is witnessing them. And John Carroll, I'm interested in your thoughts on what it means to lose one person playing that kind of role.
Yeah, everyone in the journalism world plays a particular role, even people who sit in radio booths and talk about things. But war correspondents are extremely special because of the remarkable courage they have, because of their commitment to go and bear witness to areas of conflict. And what we've seen develop over the course of decades is this shift in the status of journalists in war zones. And they've gone from largely off limits to fair game to now these sort of valuable chips that that terrorists see as a way to get revenue, a way to get publicity, and it puts them in so much more danger than they already are. I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of courage to go out there and put yourself at peril day in and day out. But now, this is an added dimension that I think is just going to be more and more difficult for journalists to navigate.
Right, that vest that says press is no guarantee of protection anymore.
Not anymore.
Adrian, I spoke this week with Alex Jones at the Shorenstein Center at Harvard's Kennedy School, and he was saying that he really hopes that Other reporters will, as he put it, pick up the pen and notebook of Jim Foley. And despite this execution that was, you know, presumably expected to scare people from going back, that they will go there and keep covering this war. Do you, Adrian, working in an active newsroom, even though the Globe has no more overseas bureaus, has there been this conversation about whether this chills reporters who might want to go overseas?
Yes, there has. And I don't think it will chill reporters who want to go overseas. I hope Alex is right, and I think he will be right. I mean, it's a special breed of person who wants to cover conflict for a career, and I think that the people who want to do that will not be scared off by this, even though I agree with John that it's only gotten more dangerous in recent years.
John, a question for you as someone who spends time evaluating ads and media coverage. This obviously was an enormous story this week, covered in many different ways by many different media outlets. Did you get a sense of who you think did well, who might have been crass in their coverage?
I think it's a high wire act always, and I think you saw a lot of the usual suspects who tried to take political advantage of this. I think one of the things that's been hardest to navigate is covering the family itself, and I think that that the Foley family in general has displayed a remarkable fortitude and grace and optimism, as you heard Jim Foley's father saying. We got this email that was absolutely terrifying, and we still had hope that something might happen. Interestingly, Jim Foley's brother and sister, Michael and Katie, went on the Katie Couric show on Yahoo News. She has a news program, and they said they thought the U.S. could have done more. And this is sort of a bit of a split in the family. They thought they could have done more. They seemed to be talking about exchanging prisoners at Guantanamo for Jim Foley. And I think that that's going to be the next conversation, is how can you avoid these situations without encouraging them? A lot of revenue has gone to terrorists from European countries who are willing to pay in some cases, and from families as well, whose money has been channeled to terrorists. So I think that's going to be the next question. It's a tough one for the U.S. to encounter, especially in light of how graphic and how dramatic and how sad this situation has been.
I also noticed that on the day that Jim Foley's death was confirmed, there was a family member of the Foleys tweeting and basically saying, do not watch the video. Of course, Jim Foley was beheaded, and she basically said, don't watch it. That's what the militants want, and if you watch into it, you sort of like buy into that. Adrian, do you have any sense of whether that message resonates?
I think it resonates to some degree. You see that Twitter and YouTube blocked the video pretty quickly and made it very difficult to watch. I mean, personally, I wouldn't dream of watching it.
Another serious topic that's been getting a lot of attention this week is the ongoing confrontations down in Ferguson, Missouri, between protesters and police. And that has spurred a big national conversation about race and inequality and the so-called militarization of the police. We had that conversation this week on the air on Radio Boston. On CNN, Jake Tapper took flack for some comments he made on air Monday night when he was down in Ferguson, and he commented on the police response to a group of nonviolent protesters, and he was criticized for what some people perceived as editorializing. Here's what he said.
These are armed police with semi-automatic rifles, with batons, with shields, many of them dressed for combat. Now, why they're doing this, I don't know.
Now, for the sort of opposite side of that sense of surprise, we spoke on Tuesday with Bill Brooks. He's the chief of police in Norwood, Massachusetts. And Chief Brooks makes the case that this is more police modernization, not militarization. You know, he says for a long time, police have used helmets and military rifles and shields in certain circumstances. And he also says that SWAT teams here in Massachusetts, there's actually a SWAT team collective that towns can call on if they don't have their own. He says those SWAT teams have saved lives over the past decade.
When they go out, they bring the bear with them in case they need something armored to get them closer to the scene. In all of those years, there's been one fatality. And there's no way that number of situations of people with mental illness or people with firearms or people who are a threat to themselves or others could ever have been resolved with only a single fatality in all those years had it not been for a well-trained and properly equipped team.
Now, when he referred to the bear, he was talking about Bearcats, those big armored vehicles. Adrian Walker, clearly there is a place and not a place for armored police. What is your take on what we've seen in Ferguson with regard to militarized police departments?
I think what we saw in Ferguson was that most of what the police did for the first week was just incredibly inflammatory and unnecessary. I mean, they were policing a riot, but where was the riot? And this is where I think Tapper is exactly right. You know, they're unarmed protesters facing down, you know, facing tear gas, and for no good reason. And I think the militarization issue is real. I think it is a problem that the toys have got, if you will, have gotten more and more powerful and sophisticated.
One of the things Chief Brooks says in pushback to that is, you know, look, we have learned that anything can happen anywhere, despite many people after tragedies striking saying, you know, this doesn't happen in places like this. And he believes you have to have at least the tactical capacity. So you need to have that kind of equipment. How do you feel when you hear that argument, Adrian?
You know, there was a terrific story in the New York Times earlier this week about the militarization of small town police departments. And of course, this is surplus military equipment. And you look at these small towns where nothing's ever happened, and you say, why on earth do they need a tank? I mean, I guess anything could happen anywhere, but it's awfully unlikely. And I think a lot of this stuff really is not necessary.
What do you think, John Carroll?
Yeah, this has turned into a bit of a sideshow. You've got this whole spectrum. On one end, you've got the Saginaw County sheriff getting rid of an MRAP, a mine-resistant, ambush-proof vehicle that they had days after John Oliver mocked him on his HBO show. And he said, we don't really need it here in Saginaw County. In the middle,
he acknowledged it,
right,
was unnecessary.
Right, and it was costing them money. So he didn't want to keep it. In the middle, you've got politicians like Rand Paul and Claire McCaskill who are trying to make this a political issue and using Congress for hearings to essentially re-examine this. And then at the other end, you've got the National Tactical Officers Association, which lobbies for 1,600 SWAT teams around the country, going to Congress and saying, don't take our military vehicles away from us because we need them to fight the drug war, which is where these things started, and also in counterterrorism. The question is, are these there to protect against action, or are they actually creating action that they then have to react to? And I think that that's one of the things that Ferguson has brought to the fore.
Right, because it gets into that argument of once you have the equipment, do you want to use the equipment? Suddenly, just to serve a warrant, does the SWAT team come out when it may not have been necessary?
Right, and you never know when it's going to be an overreaction. I remember in 2004 when we had the Democratic National Convention here, the Boston Police Department looked like a bunch of Ninja Turtles. And it just seemed so excessive at the time. And now what you have is a lot of sort of over-equipped. There's been $5 billion worth of military equipment dispersed to law enforcement agencies. So you've got a lot of over-equipped people, and the rule is, you know, technology creates its own need and its own use. If you have it, you tend to use it, and I think that's the problem.
And that surplus weaponry being distributed is increasing as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan wind down, and the military has equipment it doesn't need and sells them at fairly cheap rates to local departments.
They give them away, actually.
Yeah, a lot of it's free.
Free, Adrian, is that right? Free,
yes.
not just discount, but just take it?
A lot of it is free, yes.
Mm. John and Adrian, I want to talk a bit about the governor's race. The primary's coming up soon, obviously, so candidates are making their closing arguments to voters for why they deserve the state's highest office. Martha Coakley is out with an ad in which she casts herself as an outsider.
Martha Coakley is running for governor with a plan to build an economy that works for everyone. The political insiders, the big money super PACs, the old boys club, they're all against her. That's okay. She's not fighting for them. She's fighting for us.
John Carroll, a.k.a. campaign outsider, what do you make of Coakley's ad there?
Yeah, this is a bit of a stretch, I think. Martha Coakley's an outsider as much as Deval Patrick is a shortstop for the Red Sox. I just don't think that's going to fly, especially in light of some of the news coverage lately. There's this whole rumpus over John Brennan and the Brennan Group, lobbyists who seem to get kind of an easy deal from Martha Coakley. Lobbyists have been sort of the ATM wing of the Democratic Party. So she looks like she's playing a lot of insider politics from the Partners Healthcare acquisition of South Shore Hospital and Hallmark Health Systems to this Brennan Group. I mean, what they're trying to do, and this is true of Steve Grossman, Don Berwick, Charlie Baker, they're all trying to paint her as sort of a captive of the Beacon Hill forces. And I think it's a hard thing for her to convince people that she's not part of it.
Adrian, in that ad, we basically heard Coakley just ignoring her primary challengers and going right for her general election pitch. Do you feel like the Democratic nomination is hers at this point?
I think it would be tough for her to lose it at this point, yes. Even though her opponents are waging a very energetic campaign, they don't seem to be able to cut into her lead for whatever reason.
I also want to play an ad from Republican Charlie Baker. This one was released on Wednesday.
Martha Coakley and Steve Grossman. Politics as usual on Beacon Hill. we can do better.
The old way of spending more and taxing more isn't working. We need new ideas and a new approach. When I'm governor, we'll lower taxes, reduce wasteful spending, and reform welfare.
Adrian, Charlie Baker seems to be focusing on, you know, his theme that a vote for a Democrat is a vote for the status quo. Do you think that could be a winning theme?
That could be a winning theme. I mean, his whole argument is that one party rule, as he would put it, has been bad for Massachusetts, and we need to expand that. And it's been a winning theme before, and perhaps it will be again. We'll see.
And John Carroll, what do you think as Charlie Baker tries again to win elective office?
He's gone back to the tried and true. I mean, that spot is all about waste, fraud, and abuse, which is mm-hmm. the oldest saw in politics. And
in welfare.
Exactly. So I think that essentially Charlie Baker is playing a very conservative game. He's looking at tactics that have proven effective in the past for Bill Weld, for Paul Cellucci. There was a time when Massachusetts residents really believed, or voters anyway, really believed that two-party rule on Beacon Hill was a good thing for the Commonwealth. And so he's trying to ride that same wave again. Whether it works this time around is hard to say.
I want to touch at least briefly on the Attorney General's race, which has been getting relatively much less attention. Former State Senator Warren Tolman and political newcomer Maura Healey are the two Democrats in the primary. There's also Republican John Miller. But the race between Tolman and Healey is getting very close. Adrian, are you watching this one much? And do you have any thoughts that you want to share?
Oh, yeah, I'm watching it closely, and it's turned into a really, really good race. I mean, this really is a race of an insider, Warren Tolman, against an outsider in Healey. And she's doing a lot better than people would have expected at the beginning, and I think it's close and will stay close.
I want to now get to our hubbubs. Both of you have been on the show. You know that at the end of the week, we try to, you know, look for little items that maybe slipped off the people's radar. John Carroll, what did you bring today as your hubbub?
My hubbub comes from ValleyWag, which is a blog from Gawker, the online media company. And the headline of this post was, "People keep getting into strangers' cars because they think it's an Uber." And so what's happening is these cars, these SUVs, and these are pulling up to the curb, and people are just jumping in them. So one person in New York got in and said, "Are you Uber? Well, can you just be? Can we go?" People are tweeting. One tweeted that he booked a cab, got in, and thought, "This is unusually weed-scented." Turns out he wasn't in his car from Uber. He was in a drug dealer's car. So this is a problem. Everybody just be careful and Uber safely.
And a problem Lyft doesn't have with its pink fender mustaches.
Exactly.
Right?
There's a lot of people calling for purple mustaches for Uber.
Adrian Walker, what's your hubbub this week?
Well, mine comes from Time Magazine, which says that Tufts is offering a class this fall called Demystifying the Hipster. It says students will become critics and sociologists of today's hipster culture as they explore how hipster identity reflects larger cultural anxiety. And I was reading this, and all I could think was Miles Davis is somewhere having a big laugh about this.
Man, I went to college too early.
I'm trying to think of what that class then qualifies you to do. What does that add to your skill set?
Debunk
probably
the hipsters.
Not very much. That's right. You can be a professional debunker.
Exactly. All right. So for mine, I want to mention that Muck Rock, this local organization that basically specializes in freedom of information requests, decided that it wanted to make a public records request for the so-called goat-scaping program in Hyde Park. This is the city having sort of rented, in a way, four goats that are now living on 2 acres in Hyde Park that have been overrun by invasive plants and poison ivy, and their job is to help get rid of those. All right. So Muck Rock wanted to know, all right, how much money, what are the details of this? So two things I'll mention are that the cost of this is $2,800. That's to rent the goats, but it's a grant, so there's no cost to the city. As far as how much they're supposed to chew off, it is so specific that it says that they have to chew so that the targeted vegetation will be no more than 4 inches high, with the exception of woody stems or vines with stems 0.5 centimeter or thicker. Now, I don't know who's out there supposed to measure that, but it's quite precise.
I say SEIU comes in and organizes and unionizes those goats within a week.
I love it.
Are the goats making minimum wage? That's what I want to know.
John Carroll and Adrian Walker, thank you so much for being our Week in Review panel this week. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Carroll is a professor of communications at Boston University. He also writes the Campaign Outsider blog. And Adrian Walker is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Both of you have a great weekend.
You too, Sasha.
Thanks, Sasha.
Stay with us. We'll be talking with the owner of Roxy's Grilled Cheese about how Boston can improve its food truck scene. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.